Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jonathan Hasid and Jim McCormick with us, two political scientists from Iowa State University. Jim, a professor of political science. Jonathan, an associate professor of political science. Jim and Jonathan, you're in our Ames studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
And we've got to plow right into it. As you heard in the news at the top of the hour, developments happening almost every hour on the impeachment process front. We'll talk about that in just a moment. We heard at the top of the hour the latest breaking news. The representative, Adam Schiff, he's, of course, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, announcing the first public hearings in the inquiry next week. Stay tuned for the degree to which Iowa Public Radio will be covering that. I'm sure there will be extra coverage of that as well. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Let's first, Jim and Jonathan, if we could, go after those off-year election results from yesterday. Democrats winning control of Virginia's government, capturing both chambers of the legislature for the first time in a generation there. Unified government for the Democrats in Virginia under Governor Ralph Northam. In Kentucky, Governor Matt Bevin, the Republican, I don't know, I think he's still refusing to concede. 100% of the precincts counted, and Attorney General Andy Beshear ahead by over 5,000 votes. I want to throw this into the mix before I get comment from the two of you. At a rally on Monday in Lexington, Kentucky, the president was there telling the audience that they needed to win that Kentucky governor's race.
If you lose, it sends a really bad message. It just sends a bad, and they will build it up. Here's the story. If you win, they're going to make it like ho-hum. And if you lose, they're going to say, Trump suffered the greatest defeat in the history of the world. This was the greatest. You can't let that happen to me.
President Trump there taking that race very personally. Jim McCormick, go at it. What are your takeaways from these or other results you see from yesterday?
Well, I think that Kentucky is really a sense of surprise in the sense that, Trump won that state by 30 percentage points in the last presidential election here. But on the other hand, Matt Bevin was not a very popular governor. He had picked fights with various constituencies, including, teachers and health care, on health care issues and so on. So I was looking at some of the polls right before the election. He was marginally ahead, but it was really a very tight race. So in that sense, it's probably not a surprise. The winner here, Beshear, of course, comes from a family in Kentucky that has been in Kentuckian politics for some time. His father was the governor and so on. So in that sense, there is a sort of a name recognition here and a bit of heredity as well.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, what jumps out at you about yesterday?
One of the interesting things, of course, was, the results in Virginia, which will give Democrats control in Virginia, not only of state government, but of the 2020 redistricting process, which will potentially hurt the GOP nationally. Now that the Supreme Court has said that partisan redistricting is fine, I fully expect that the Democrats will take advantage of that and, do a lot of partisan redistricting without the ability of the GOP to stop it. It was also interesting, the total wipeout in the suburbs that the GOP experienced, both in Kentucky, Virginia, and in Pennsylvania. So, for example, the Delaware County Council in Pennsylvania, suburban Delaware County, has never been controlled. It's a five-person board, a five-person council board, has never been controlled by Democrats since the Civil War. Today, all five members will be, incoming members will be Democrats. This is a suburban route that is not good news for Trump's reelection prospects.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I want to have the two of you, Jim and Jonathan, take off your academic hats, mortarboards, whatever, and become campaign strategists. We're 1 year out from the general election. Also, all four, of course, of our House seats up for reelection, up for election next year, including one Senate seat here in Iowa, Joni Ernst. What is this, Jim? What do these results say to Joni Ernst's team, for instance?
Well, just taking off on what Jonathan said about suburban voters here, certainly if you look at the third district last time, it was, Cindy Axne won because she won really the counties around Des Moines and in Des Moines here. She really just won Polk County, but she won got voting turnout in some of the suburban counties. So, I mean, obviously the message to, say, the Ernst campaign or even to somebody running in some of these congressional districts is that they've got to really hone in on these suburban areas and make certain that they at least get some votes out of them, as well as, because for at least for some Republican candidates, to make certain that they have the Republican rural areas fully in hand and fully supported here. So it's really a two-pronged strategy. Make sure that their base in the rural area is solidified, and then try to make some inroads, particularly on issues like health care, which continues to be, at least in the Iowa setting, a very important and prominent one for candidates this coming election.
Right, the 2018 election, one of the big issues, health care. Abby Finkenauer, Cindy Axne elected at least in part on the basis of that issue. Jonathan, what's your read on translating these results from elections outside of our state to an election 1 year away?
Of course, it's difficult. I mean, Iowa is much more rural than, say, Pennsylvania is or Virginia. Virginia in particular has been suburbanizing very quickly, especially in the D.C. suburbs, which are now basically total Democratic strongholds. And so it's hard to, you know, extrapolate that to the Iowa results. Of course, Iowa is a much more rural state. That said, I think the Ernst campaign may well, and I wouldn't be surprised if they took the lesson to sort of keep Trump at arm's length. Matt Bevin in Kentucky, you know, a heavily Republican-leaning state, embraced Trump, and Trump embraced him, and it didn't pay off. And especially with Trump's low popularity rating nationally and even in Iowa, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Joni Ernst, doesn't do rallies with Trump, right, doesn't embrace him as tightly as she might have done if he were more popular.
Okay. Before we move on, any other lessons here to take away from yesterday? What about that old saying, all politics are local? Did that bear out yesterday or to the contrary, actually, that all politics have, with this president in office, some degree of national?
I think it was nationalized. Even in the Virginia case, you can look to that. I mean, some of the commentary was that not only were they looking at some of the local issues, but they also, it was a reflection, obviously, of their geographical location next to the nation's capital. There was some response to what was going on in Washington and to the White House here. And certainly the efforts in Kentucky, I think you still have localized issues here, but with the Trump visit, that obviously began to nationalize it as well. I think we ought to mention Mississippi, where the Republicans maintain control here.
Right, by what, 5% percentage points?
Right, mm-hmm. I mean, not a huge percentage point. The Democrat became very competitive there, but nonetheless, that was also part of this kind of nationalization that at least the Trump administration attempted.
But let me just quickly point to one sort of strange outcome of the Virginia race. The Virginia mm-hmm. Democrats have promised to bring up and potentially ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, which is something that I think most Americans haven't thought about since the 70s. But potentially there's only one state away from, I mean, it's going to be an ugly court fight, but potentially we could see the resurrection because of this race, these election results, we could see the resurrection of the Equal Rights Amendment back in American politics.
I mean, there must be something on the resolution that has to be passed in a particular number of years. That's the crux of it in terms of whether that ratification effort would go forward.
Hmm. Interesting. We'll have to explore that in a future program. Good point there, Jonathan, to bring up. Let's move on, if we could, with Jonathan Haseeb, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, our political scientists on this Politics Wednesday edition of the program, to move on over to an impeachment process update. Donald Trump, of course, accused of trying to pressure Ukraine into investigating unsubstantiated corruption claims against his political rival here in the U.S., Joe Biden, and Biden's son, Hunter Biden, who worked with a Ukrainian gas company. This week, new testimony from Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the European Union. He confirmed in this newest testimony his involvement in essentially laying out what was a quid pro quo to Ukraine that he had not acknowledged up to this week's testimony. His admission, a part of a four-page sworn statement released yesterday, contradicted what he said to investigators last month when he said, quote, he never thought there was any precondition on aid. Jonathan, take this, and there was other testimony, too, from Marie Yovanovitch, the ex-envoy to Ukraine as well. What does this new testimony do for the Democrats' abuse of power case?
I mean, it certainly strengthens it. You know, it's going to be hard for Republicans to paint Sondland as a so-called never-Trumper, given that the man gave $1 million to Trump's election campaign and, of course, was personally appointed by Trump to be an EU ambassador. And so it's going to be very difficult to then turn around and say this guy's a member of the deep state and a never-Trumper. It's interesting that he changed his testimony. So before he couldn't recall whether or not there was a quid pro quo, and now he suddenly can. And I don't know if the man's memory was actually jogged by the testimony of other officials or by whether he was worried about a potential perjury charge in front of Congress. You know, none of these are positive developments for the Trump team. Their argument so far seems to have been that there's no quid pro quo, and that is no longer a tenable argument to hold. We have any number of officials, former ambassadors, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and others, really respected officials, including, you know, as I said, a guy who gave $1 million to Trump's election campaign, all saying that they believed there was a quid pro quo. And so I think we should expect that Trump and his administration will pivot into a different defense. What that defense will be, I couldn't say. So far, they're attacking the process. It'll be much more difficult to attack the process when the hearings are open, right? The complaint so far has been that the hearings are closed. But when the hearings are open, it'll be hard to attack the process.
And that is next week. And we have this other, I don't know if it's a distraction. Jim, weigh in on this. Rand Paul, I think others, wanting to out the whistleblower, name the whistleblower. Isn't that, at this point, Jim, sort of beside the point when we have so much corroboration for what happened, what that call was about?
It is beside the point, at least in terms of the Democrats' case here. But I think this is going to be a reoccurring theme on the part of the Republicans, that they'll want to call the whistleblower and kind of grill him before Congress. It's sort of widely known in the press, at least what I've read, that they know who this whistleblower is, and apparently even in the White House. So I do think that at some juncture he's going to be called, and that's going to be, in terms of sort of what Jonathan was saying, what might be the upcoming kind of strategy. It will be, I think, to make that case about the whistleblower and what was his political connections with the White House, the previous White House, and with Joe Biden here. And so turn the issue to also looking at what really was the Biden involvement and Hunter Biden involvement. I think that's what the defense strategy really will turn to make that what was done here was not anywhere equivalent to what Biden and Hunter Biden were engaged in with regard to Ukraine. And the other larger item is, was Ukraine involved in the 2016 election? I mean, this seems to be a complaint that the Republicans make constantly, that Ukraine was somehow involved in terms of supporting Hillary Clinton against the Trump candidacy here.
Any evidence of that?
The only piece of evidence, and I haven't verified it, was that there was apparently some court case in Ukraine that brought up that there was involvement of Ukraine in the election process. Hmm. I think we're going to hear more about that. I don't know the details of that at all. Maybe Jonathan has heard about it.
I have not.
Okay. Let's talk about this, the newly released first transcripts from closed-door testimony released by the Democrats. Two transcripts this week providing some new depth, detail to the concerns by top-level U.S. diplomats in Washington, also Kiev about this White House back channel pressure on the Ukrainian government. We had the ex-envoy to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, telling Congress she was, quote, very concerned by President Trump's comment on the phone call with Ukraine's leader, Donald Trump, telling his Ukrainian counterpart, well, she's going to go through some things. Also describing Ms. Yovanovitch as, quote, bad news. And she also, according to this newly released transcript, had been warned by Ukraine's justice minister that, quote, I really need to watch my back. She left in May, months ahead of her scheduled departure from Ukraine. Also from the testimony provided now from a former top advisor to the Secretary of State Pompeo, Michael McKinley. Here's Lindsey Graham, after asking for these transcripts for transparency. Lindsey Graham, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, saying here, listen closely, no plans to read the transcripts now released by the House impeachment inquiry.
From Rudy Giuliani?
No, I hadn't heard from Rudy.
Do you plan on reading these transcripts that were released?
No.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about these transcripts. What do you think, the two I named there, maybe there have been others released in the meantime.
I mean, what it really highlights is that the United States has had a shadow State Department, with Rudy Giuliani in particular conducting business on behalf of Donald Trump as an individual and not the United States as a country. And, of course, back-channel diplomacy is very common. Presidents use it all the time. But to my knowledge, this is the first time where we've seen, at least publicly, acknowledgement that a president has used this back channel for personal political advancement rather than to achieve the stated goals of U.S. foreign policy. And you know, it's clear all of the transcripts point to the involvement of Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal attorney, in trying to, you know, gin up damaging evidence against a potential domestic political opponent. And it's really quite extraordinary testimony.
Mm-hmm. This will all come down, as far as we can see, to the Senate, and more precisely to the Republicans in the Senate, being as they have control of the Senate at this time. Let's hear a couple of perspectives. Mitt Romney, certainly not representative of most of the GOP senators, in an October 30th interview, Mitt Romney says he's keeping a completely open mind when it comes to President Trump's potential impeachment.
I'm probably going to become a juror, if you will, in this process. And as a result of that, I'm doing my very best to keep an open mind. And I'm going to wait to make any comments on evidence until we see all the evidence, all the facts are laid out. And everybody makes their own decision. I respect my colleagues, and they have the capacity to make their own decisions. But in my view, it's time for me to stay silent on impeachment until the process is complete. If articles of impeachment come, I'll review the facts in depth before I make my decision.
Okay, juxtapose that with last week on October 30th. Our Senator Chuck Grassley, spoke about the impeachment of Donald Trump and how it started by referencing a Washington Post article printed days before President Trump was sworn into office.
January the 20th, 2017, a Washington Post headline read, so it had to be coming out even before he was sworn in, quote, "The campaign to impeach President Trump has begun. That campaign has been in full swing ever since. So let's make no mistake, this process about concerns over alleged high crimes and misdemeanors, as the Constitution speaks about the reasons for impeachment, they don't really mean much compared to an effort to impeach this president that started before he ever was sworn in. No, instead, this is about the Democratic Party, still bitter years later, trying to undo the 2016 election."
Okay, there you have it. Two perspectives. Chuck Grassley there and Mitt Romney. Jim McCormick, I don't know how representative those two views are. Most GOP senators in the Grassley camp.
Absolutely. I just saw a clip, I think yesterday, that Senator Mitch McConnell said that if the situation were brought to the Senate at this juncture, he knows what the outcome would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be in the direction of what Senator Grassley was talking about. You know, they have to peel off, the Democrats have to peel off 20 Republican senators to get a conviction in the Senate. So I think certainly at this stage, it's highly unlikely. I think really the wild card here is what these open hearings portend, what they bring out, how the American public reacts to these open hearings, whether they watch them, whether they absorb them, whether they, in fact, change the view. Because right now, I think the public opinion polls, at least within the public, is pretty evenly divided at, 51% or something in terms of impeachment and removal. I think the key element here is not the party differential, because, you know, the Democrats are at 80 or 90% and the Republicans are at, you know, 10 or 15%, but the independents, at least what I saw, were sort of evenly split on this. And I think that will be, you know, obviously a change factor that these hearings will impact on.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, do you see that? The independents really the key to weighing in, perhaps swaying some GOP senators?
Certainly. If independents break heavily for impeachment and removal, then you'll have a lot of pressure on particularly vulnerable Republican senators to vote to convict. We're not there yet. We may not get there. But, you know, during the Nixon impeachment hearings, it was the public hearings that really swung public opinion in favor. So before that, the public did not particularly support, if you look back historically, did not support Nixon's removal. But then once the public hearings came out, the televised hearings, that was a big momentum shift. And that's ultimately what led to Nixon's removal. Now, that didn't happen during the Clinton impeachment. The Clinton impeachment was never very popular politically, and the hearings didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have to see, right, if there are major revelations that come out by people with unimpeachable credibility saying unequivocally that Trump did this bad thing or that bad thing, then we may start to see independents move. And if independents move, you're going to peel off some vulnerable Republicans.
Yeah, there's 24 Republican senators up for re-election here.
So, very quickly before we go to break, sorry to interrupt, Jim, we've got about a minute left, but what about the refusal of several White House members to testify in the impeachment inquiry? Adam Schiff says that's further evidence of obstruction of justice. Quickly, on that note, before we end this.
Well, that might be one of the charges that they bring up in terms of an obstruction charge on the part of the White House. And, you know, would that get into that category that would be convincing to the public of high crimes and misdemeanors?
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment with more analysis from Jim McCormick and Jonathan Hasid, political scientists at Iowa State University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, River to River from River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email, 1-866-780-9100. We're going to move on from impeachment. That is sort of the black hole of politics. It seems to suck everything into its center, but we're going to try to move on to some other topics. The withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. I want to get Jim and Jonathan's view on that. Also, some polls showing Donald Trump remaining highly competitive in battleground states, likeliest to decide his reelection. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
Midstream on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. A reminder, tomorrow on this program for you political junkies, Cory Booker is scheduled to join me tomorrow over the noon hour live. You can email your questions now for Senator Cory Booker, Democratic presidential candidate, to our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And tune in tomorrow, Thursday, live. Also tomorrow on the program, Oscar-winning writer and director Alex Gibney, a fascinating new documentary he has on about the Russian oligarchy and an oligarch-turned-dissident. We'll talk with him tomorrow on this program as well. Today, Jonathan Hasid and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University are political scientists as we rapidly move through the rapidly developed developing story with impeachment. Incidentally, if you haven't heard, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee just announcing the first public hearings, the first ones into this inquiry to begin next week. Before we get on to the Paris Climate Accord, the U.S. withdrawal from that, Jim and Jonathan, I want to ask you about this related to the investigation. Of course, the president has been the subject of many, many investigations and lawsuits since he took office, including, of course, the Mueller look at his campaign ties to Russia. Now a new case concerning an investigation by Manhattan prosecutors into hush money payments to two women who said they had affairs with Trump. This perhaps looking to reach our nation's highest court. Donald Trump will ask the Supreme Court to rule on his claim that he is absolutely immune from criminal investigation while he remains in office. Many more details, but let me get your view on this, Jim, first of all. If the court, high court, agrees to hear this case, what are the stakes in terms of limits of presidential power? Have we faced this before?
Yes, we did. I mean, the analogy immediately comes to mind for me is sort of the Nixon tapes case, you know, when it went to the Supreme Court. And, you know, of course, that was a ringing defeat for President Nixon in terms of making those tapes available, that the White House tapes that I'm referring to here. And the case, as I understand it, if it would go to the Supreme Court, they would have to render a decision by the end of June here, June 2020. And, of course, that would be very much dead set in the center of the presidential campaign well underway. And whatever decision they would render would have reverberating effects across the
right.
across the country and the landscape of the election.
Right. And at the heart of this, I didn't mention the president's attempt to keep his financial records private. He does not want those tax returns released. Weigh in on this, Jonathan.
I would be surprised if the Supreme Court takes the case. Of course, the Supreme Court can deny certiorari, which means they can refuse to accept the case. That would be my guess as to what they'll do. So in other words, they can stay out of this on technical grounds. They're going to have to wade in on other cases later on. The reason this case is a little bit different is that this is a subpoena not to Trump personally, but to his accounting firm, Mazars.
Mm-hmm.
And they already have the documents, and they've said that they're willing to comply. It seems to me that it's a stretch to make this a claim of presidential immunity when the tax documents are already in the hands of a third party. And I suspect that the Supreme Court will see it that way. However, regardless of what happens with them, if Trump loses, as I suspect he will, it's unlikely that these tax documents will see the light of day. These are subpoenaed as part of a secret grand jury hearing, and grand jury testimony and documents are secret and unlikely to come out. So in the end, I think that the Trump administration is going to have to show his tax returns, but not via this case.
Just one addendum here. On certiorari, you only need four judges. to have the Supreme Court to review the case.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of the composition of the court, there might well be four Supreme Court justices that will agree to hear the case. But we'll have to see, I guess.
Okay. Four justices to decide that the case is taken on by the Supreme Court, but five, of course,
sure.
For a majority, five or more.
Right.
That's right.
Okay. Let's talk about the Paris Climate Accord. On Monday, the Trump administration said it filed paperwork to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Agreement. This is the first formal step in a one-year process to exit this pact to fight global climate change. A broader strategy this is a part of by the president to reduce, he says, red tape on American industry. Scientists, though, the overwhelming number of scientists around the world concerned with climate urge rapid action to avoid the worst impacts of global warming. This is interesting. Once it exits, the U.S., and we have to remember the U.S. is one of the top greenhouse gas emitters, will become the only country outside of this accord. We have a president that has long mocked climate change, calling it a hoax. Jonathan, what does this mean internationally?
It's certainly not a good sign for U.S. leadership internationally. There are 194 signatories to this. And, the way the climate accord is structured is that there's not really a binding mechanism to enforce it on countries. That is to say, it's up to individual governments to implement their own regulations and policies to reduce emissions. And so there's only as much red tape as the country will make. In other words, the agreement by itself doesn't force a country to do anything, and in fact, there's no mechanism to do that with the United Nations. This is basically, a way that the U.S. Looks like it's ceding global leadership to places like China and the European Union. And in reality, the climate accord, though symbolically important, was never binding and perhaps never all that strong to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other evidence is that so far that many of the countries that even have committed to these voluntary contributions have not really lived up to their commitments and sort of the interim deadline here of 2030 that has been set for several countries. It's unlikely, at least a report that I read, it's unlikely that many of the countries are likely to meet those standards. So the voluntarism that undergirds the Paris Accord is really continuous to be the problem. And of course, they wouldn't have the Paris Accord if they had any kind of real strong enforcement mechanism, it seems to me.
If you just joined us, Jim McCormick and Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Let's move on to talk about the elections about a year away and the Iowa caucuses less than 90 days away. Two polls in particular. I know polls everywhere as the weeks fly by, but two to point out here because they juxtapose a national poll with state polls. A Washington Post ABC News poll released yesterday. In it, Donald Trump loses in a hypothetical matchup with all the leading candidates for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. But given our electoral college system, that may not be very important. Let's talk about this poll, which I think a lot of people have their eyes on. President Trump facing low national approval ratings. We know that, about 40, hovering around there. Also, this shadow of impeachment. Despite this, a new set of surveys show he remains highly competitive in battleground states, the states that are likeliest to decide his reelection. These are surveys from the New York Times, Upshot, and Siena College polls, the six closest states that went Republican in 2016. What did this poll tell you, Jim?
Well, I was surprised to see that Trump was still as competitive as he was. But then if you step back a moment in terms of think about some of the issues that the Democrats are talking about, maybe it helps us understand that. Medicare for All, which has gotten a lot of play. And in some of these states, there are a number of union members in those states, and they have health plans, I think, that they would like to really keep here. And Medicare for All might endanger those. If you just point to the latest United Auto Workers contract, achieved here, that one of the things was improvement in terms of health care benefits as well as wages and so on. And those would be sort of jettisoned if you went to this Medicare for All. So that might be part of the reason here. Some of these states are rural, have rural dominance here as well, or at least large rural sectors, which I think also might account for some of Trump's popularity. And I think the third factor to point to is, of course, the economy still continues to even if it has not reached the kind of growth rates that the Trump administration set out at the beginning, jobs are still seemingly available. There's a lot of hiring going on, and there is at least some uptick, modest as it is, in personal income.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, what are you seeing less than 90 days from the Iowa caucuses, just under a year from the general election?
The first important thing to remember is that any one poll should be taken with a grain of salt. It's much more important to look at polling averages than looking at any one individual poll. Part of the reason that's true is that the so-called secret sauce of polling is trying to figure out who's going to be a likely voter. And that's hard to do, especially if, say, voter enthusiasm is very high or very low. It's hard to do that. But in terms of Trump's popularity in these battleground states, I think to sort of pick up a little bit on what Jim said, a lot of it comes down to demographics. These are states that are, relative to the national average, heavily white working class states. And of course, this is Trump's demographic group, right? White voters without a college education are Trump's biggest source of demographic support. And these are states, places like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. These are states that are more white and more working class than average. And so basically, Trump may have an uphill battle nationwide, but of course, as we were reminded once again in 2016, the U.S. presidential election isn't a nationwide election. It's, you know, 51 state elections and D.C. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But the other outcome was that in some of these battleground states, what happened in 2016 was that there was not this kind of great urban turnout. You take Wisconsin in particular, you know, Milwaukee County, you know, which is obviously heavily has traditionally been heavily Democratic, really had low turnout rates. And that was pointed to because, you know, the state of Wisconsin was lost by something like 30,000 votes. And the failure to get turnout there was really critical. So we really do have to add into this mix, as Jonathan correctly pointed out, the turnout that we're likely to see. Mm-hmm. Is this going to be an election in 2020 which there is so much enthusiasm that there will be a great turnout, or will the campaigns be so negative that it will really turn off some voters and they will stay home?
Let me just very quickly say, I think we're going to see a high turnout election next year, based on the elections from yesterday and based on other special elections we've
higher
seen
so than
far. 2008. I won't go on the record predicting one way or another.
58% or something like that. That was huge.
Huge, yeah. But I think we're going to see high turnout election.
Mm, okay. Let's talk about this before we move on. Of course, the great debate within the Democratic Party as this nominating process is underway. I'd like to get your thoughts on the great debate of centrist versus progressive potential nominees here. Biden and Buttigieg, Harris representing we would say more centrist views, Warren and Sanders, the more progressive wing of that. Of course, most Democratic voters, I think, polls show, want first and foremost electability to beat Donald Trump. The question is how. What are your thoughts there, Jonathan?
It varies by state, right? So if you look at the state polls in Iowa, for example, and New Hampshire, Warren right now is the front runner. But these are not, again, nationally demographically representative states. The Democratic Party in Iowa is whiter and more liberal than the national average. And so I think we would expect that Warren would have an advantage here relative to Joe Biden. Joe Biden is unlikely to be unseated in a place like South Carolina, where he has has a huge amount of African-American support, or in a place like Nevada, which is more working class and sort of less educated than Iowa is in terms of the voters in the Democratic Party. We're really going to see two races, right? We're going to see the Iowa caucuses and then the New Hampshire primary. I think it's likely to favor Warren or perhaps Sanders. And then the later races, Joe Biden is going to do well.
Mm-hmm. To finish up our program, let's go international with both of your expertise outside of the United States in foreign policy, international relations, and so forth. We have two anniversaries I'd like you to comment on. This week, Monday, marked the 40th, has it been so long, that long, 40th anniversary of the 1979 student takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and that subsequent 444-day hostage crisis under President Carter. Yeah. Also coming up this weekend, 30 years since the fall of the wall this weekend in Berlin, then a divided city. I remember those so well, the hostage taking. I was in junior high, the Berlin Wall. I was actually there reporting the day of the fall of the wall. Comment, Jim, on Iran, first of all. This really opened up a new era.
Well, the 40 years,
decades of animosity with the United States.
Yeah, the 40 years of animosity with the United States is absolutely correct, because that was really the kind of a turning point in American policy. Of course, we had embraced the Shah going back to there was a coup in 1953 that was at least in part supported by the Americans here, and the Shah was put back on the peacock throne. And, that was a period in which the United States poured a lot of money into Iran, poured a lot of arms into Iran. It was at one time that Iran and Saudi Arabia would be kind of the linchpin of American policy within the Middle East, within the Arab Muslim Middle East here. And, of course, that all changed on November 4th, 1979. Actually, it started a little bit earlier with Khomeini's return to Iran, and then the revolution that that ensued, and then the seizure of the embassy there and the holding, as you correctly pointed out, for 444 days. It was really a low point, it seems to me, in terms of American policy, because I remember very vividly, of course, that was a start. We had this ABC newscaster, Ted Koppel, which you may well know. He started this series, America Held Hostage, on ABC News.
Everybody watched it.
Everybody watched it at 10:30, at least in the Midwest at night. Day one, day two, day ad infinitum here, it seemed like, before, and seemingly no real progress in terms of getting those hostages released. And that, of course, has morphed into this continued hostility. I was telling my class the other day about, you know, 1979, we started putting sanctions on Iran, and now we have a booklet, a very large booklet of sanctions that we have put on Iran in the ensuing years for various kinds of issues that have developed, of course, most recently over nuclear, possible nuclear weaponry development here.
Jonathan Haseeb, share your thoughts on these two anniversaries.
Well, I would say that the Iran sanctions seem to have been about as effective as the sanctions on Cuba, which is to say they've achieved very little in terms of U.S. foreign policy goals. The Iranian hostage situation was before my time, but I do remember as a 9-year-old watching the Berlin Wall come down, and that was it was a big deal for me at the time. I think one interesting legacy is that, we still in a certain sense have a Europe divided by the wall. Obviously, we have the EU, right, and places in Eastern Europe, but countries like Poland and Hungary are, of course, part of the European Union. But there's still a very different attitude in Eastern Europe. A lot of people see Viktor Orban's in Hungary, the Hungarian president dictator, as, moving Hungary toward an authoritarian system. Similar in Poland, there's been a lot of worries about democratic backsliding. And so it's interesting that you can sort of still point to legacies of the Berlin Wall. Even inside Germany, Eastern Germany today, in spite of, many, many hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that have been poured in terms of investment by the West, is still much poorer than the West. It's still, there's still these communist legacies that persist even 30 years on. It just goes to show you that history casts a long shadow.
Mm-hmm. An interesting connection between the 40th anniversary of the Iran embassy takeover and the Berlin Wall is, Jim, the 1979 hostage taking had quite a bit to do with ushering Ronald Reagan into office. And, of course, Ronald Reagan later in his term uttering those phrase, tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev.
Absolutely. That's a very interesting kind of connection. You're absolutely right. It did produce a kind of a transformation in policy in one sense, because even Jimmy Carter in his last year in office, of course, adopted a different kind of foreign policy, which really foreshadowed what the Reagan administration would then pursue in terms of, creating this aura of the evil empire and the effort to transform the Soviet Union itself, as well as all of Central Europe.
Connections even to today, when we think about President Carter's failed attempt to rescue those hostages, wasn't that that operation called Desert One? Helicopter problems there doomed that to failure. This last successful downing of the ISIS leader, Baghdadi, what was it, 8 helicopters?
There were both 8 helicopters. That's a very good point. Exactly right.
With 200 elite forces from the United States in on that one to what it seems like assure the success.
Yeah, it was a much smaller grouping going into Iran because the way they had to do a two-step effort in terms of the hostage rescue attempt.
Let me finish up this way with our public hearings beginning next week on the impeachment inquiry. Let me finish up with a few seconds, half a minute to each of you, perhaps, on what you'll be watching in the next week in these public hearings. Jonathan, you first, please.
I'll be watching to see what Republican House members do in these hearings. Are they going to, take the process seriously? Are they going to try to throw a smokescreen up? As Mitch McConnell said 2 years ago, when you complain about process, you're losing. And it seems to me that we haven't gotten a lot of substantive defense out of the GOP yet. And I wonder if we'll see that during the hearings or if it's just going to be attacks on the process.
I think it's going to be an attack on the chair because, you know, the hostility
Adam
that has
Schiff.
Been expressed towards Adam Schiff will really be, I think, the beginning point. And I want to see how that plays out and what Schiff's attitude is towards calling any witnesses that the Republicans might want.
Okay, it's all ahead of us, and we're so glad we have you, Jim, and Jonathan, to give us analysis over the coming weeks. Jim McCormick, Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, thanks for coming into our studio, guys.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Once again, a reminder, tomorrow on our program, we're scheduled to have Democratic presidential candidate Senator Cory Booker live on our program. If you'd like to send a question for Senator Booker now to us, our email is rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Cory Booker live tomorrow on the program. Also, a conversation I'm having with Oscar-winning writer and director Alex Gibney. Fascinating new film. He has a documentary, Citizen K, all about the Russian oligarchy and dissension in post-Soviet Russia. River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.